the first sheet ready, and we'll put it online later this afternoon. And we'll talk about it tomorrow in the first tutorial. So this will be an informal affair, of course, because we don't have any sheet to talk about. So we'll just, I mean, not solve one anyway. So we'll just talk about the exercises on the current sheet, maybe some examples, and generally see if everybody's happy. Second point related, have you formed groups of at least two people?
No,
you haven't. Okay, so let's maybe arrange this now. Who isn't in a group? Oh, that's almost everyone. So why don't I just, you know, lay back for a moment while you guys all get into groups.
We can leave it for the tutorial.
Or we can leave it for the tutorial. Yeah, that's okay. So, yeah, right, maybe you can discuss this offline without us present. That's maybe not such a good idea. So, I'll ask again tomorrow at the tutorial. Right? So, okay, so the guys that can't make it for the tutorial are, or at least for Tuesdays, are in groups already anyway, right? Good. Right, so now I should try to cover the material that is on the sheet so you can actually do it. So, this will be a new topic, although still in classical propositional logic, but one that hasn't been employed, namely the sequent calculus for classical propositional logic. This goes back to a German logician who worked in the, well, roughly the 20s, 30s of the previous century, Gerhard Gentzen. I mean, it's a great achievement, so that makes this guy a famous guy. It's a bit of a two-sided thing because this guy died in 1945, an unreformed Nazi. That's what I mean. Okay, so what is the idea of the sequent calculus? Well, you've seen natural deduction in Gloyn, right? Natural deduction has rules like this one, for instance, the one for disjunction, just to pick the most complicated one, the elimination rule for disjunction, but hopefully some of you recall. So this is an elimination rule, meaning I want to actually conclude something from a disjunction, say a disjunction phi or psi. So, of course, it's the very nature of a disjunction that I don't know which of these two things is true, phi or psi. So, say if I want to prove something chi under that assumption, thereby eliminating the disjunction symbol here, hence the name elimination rule, I have to show that under the first alternative I can derive my conclusion chi, and I have to show that I can derive it also under the second alternative psi, and if I manage that and I have the disjunction phi or psi, then I'm allowed to actually conclude chi. So that's the elimination rule for disjunction in what's called natural deduction. So there's two things to see here. It ain't called natural deduction for nothing. So this is really the way we proceed in paper proofs, at least if we do it right. So teaching people a natural deduction system, or teaching students a natural deduction system, at the same time tells them how to write correct proofs on paper. If you are presented with a disjunction and you're supposed to prove something from it, then this is what you do. You make a case distinction over which of the two disjuncts is true, and then you prove whatever you have to prove in each of the two cases. So that's the upside. The downside is that when you really look at what these proofs are, then natural deduction proofs are sort of complicated beasts, right? What you see here is not just a proof, it's a proof that has subproofs, which we see here. And these subproofs come with extra assumptions that appear here in square brackets, and these square brackets are short notation for, well, after I apply the rule, I actually discharge the assumptions, so after applying the rule, they're no longer there. Which is sort of something you can say, but which is not quite as easy to write down as a formal system when you really get down to it. And because that's an actual technical difficulty, Gentzen came up with the idea of basically producing a slightly flatter version of these highly structured proofs, so you would get a system that you would actually be able to handle technically. And this system would talk about things that actually capture deductions. So basically what you see here is you sort of get deductions in the rule premises. If I can deduce chi from phi, then. So what you do is you actually come up with a symbol for deducibility. And this symbol is going to be this. It's the one that we standardly use for deducibility, right? It's distinguished from the very similar symbol that we've seen in the semantic definition last time by having only one vertical bar, right? So one vertical bar means syntactic, two vertical bar means semantic. And then you write things on the left and on the right of this turnstile here. So these are then actual formulas. So you write formulas phi 1 up to phi n, say, on the left side, and psi 1 up to psi m, not necessarily the same number, on the right-hand side. And this captures a formal proof. Namely, it captures proving something from assumptions. These are actually called. So phi 1 up to phi n are the assumptions. So this captures things like the phi and psi in square brackets that you see up there in this rule. So you make assumptions and you prove things under these assumptions, and you keep explicit record of these assumptions. And here, these are the so-called propositions, so the things that you conclude from these assumptions. Now you can actually translate this, at least in standard classical propositional logic, into an equivalent formula. And just to make immediately clear how we should read this, I'm going to do that in a moment. For the assumptions, it's pretty clear what I do. To basically form the formula out of a list of assumptions. I just conjoin them, right? And if I assume formulas phi 1 up to phi n, then that's basically the same as assuming their conjunction phi 1 and phi n. So let's write this down. And well, the turnstile means logical derivation. I mean, we sort of have a reflex on how to write that at the object level as well, so I'm deliberately confusing the object and the meta level now. That's basically what's behind this. So if I press this down to the object level, then it becomes an implication. Then this is not quite so clear. I mean, what does it mean to have several propositions that I just joined together behind one turnstile? Gentzen came up with the correct answer to that. This actually becomes a disjunction. Well, we talked about conjunctive normal forms last time. And if you recall what that is, a conjunctive normal form was a big conjunction, and the conjuncts were so-called clauses, right? And a clause, again, is a big disjunction of literals. Well, a literal can be either capitalized the atoms, right? So a literal can be either a negated atom, so let's say we have n of these, or it can be a positive atom, let's say we have m of these. So if we look at this formula, and remember how disjunction and first of all how disjunction behaves with respect to negation, and first of all we can transform this by pulling out the negation, right? So we have we pull out the negation sign, then we have conjunctions here, so this becomes a1 and etc. and an. Conjunctions remain for the moment. And then we remember how we encoded implication, right? Implication A implies B is just not A or B. So this here is the same by definition as conjunction of the one up to AN implies B1 or etc. or BM. So this is the same format as we find here, right? So, basically, to the right, we have a disjunction of things that we can conclude, and to the left, we have assumptions that we make, which we see conjunctively. So that is the informal reading of the whole thing. I haven't yet defined what a sequent is. I'm going to do that now. More precisely, what I'm going to define is a two-sided sequent. There's one-sided versions of this, but for the moment we stick to the two-sided case. So what is a two-sided sequent? Well, first of all, it looks like this. It has this turnstile, and it has things to the left and to the right of the turnstile. So, consists of, well, what does it consist of? It consists of gamma and delta, right? I mean, it doesn't really consist of the turnstile is just syntax to separate the two. So, what it consists of are two so-called multi-sets of formulas, gamma and delta, or I should say. Is everybody familiar with the term multiset? No. Okay, is everybody familiar with the term set?
Who is?
Sorry?
Who is familiar with the term?
Who is familiar with the term set? So who knows what a set is? No, you don't know what a set is. So
No, I know, it's just really fussy. People are arguing a lot over the definition.
Ah, right, okay, so you can actually okay. Yeah, right, so there is the problem that you can't actually define what a set is, you can only axiomatize what a set is and then dash your head in whether or not what you axiomatized is actually satisfiable, right? Okay, so since we're talking about finite things here, it's not really a problem, right? So I can tell you what a finite set is, right? Okay, so in particular, in a finite set, if I form a set of the elements apple, and pear, then that is the same as the set apple and pear, right? Because basically the two mentions of the word apple just reiterate the information that apple is in the set, and that's all I care about. Right? So a set is just determined by which things are in it and which are not. So putting a thing twice into a set doesn't change the set. Not so in a multi-set, right? So I write a multi-set with, well, the same brackets, but a vertical bar attached to them, then, let me be slightly more brief here. So let's say, a multiset is also called a bag in computer science, which is a very suggestive term because it sounds like a shopping bag, right? So if I have a bag with two apples and three pears in it, then that is not at all the same as a bag with two apples and only two pears in it. So, so what is a finite multiset over a set X or of elements of X, right? So here I'm talking about finite multisets over the set of all formulas or finite multisets of formulas. Well, that's a map from X to the natural number, so it tells me for each element of X how often is it in the multiset. Well, the multiset should be finite, so I haven't said that yet. So I demand that the set of all X, of course in the base set X, the set of all those X that are actually in my bag, in my shopping bag, that is, that have multiplicity properly greater than 0, which means at least 1. I demand that this thing is finite. So basically, a multiset is a shopping bag that contains finitely many things with a given multiplicity for each of these. I don't care about the ordering, so this here, for instance, is equal to this multiset that I've written on the right, APAP. So this contains as many apples and as many pears. I just changed the order in which I write them, and I don't care about that. So basically, a set doesn't care about either frequency or order. But a multiset, while not caring about order, does care about frequency. So, now I've said what a sequent is. So, example. Well, at the same time, I'm going to show you implicitly how I write this. Representing multisets, so I don't want to actually use this bracket with bar notation. I want to keep it even more economical. right? So this here is an example of a secret. So the list of formulas on the right, list of formulas on the left. So I can only write them as lists, but I mean them modulo commutation of the list elements. So this here would be the same. As this, for instance. So here I've basically swapped the middle two ones. I've named A or B first, only then A. The rest I've left where they are. So this would this I would regard as exactly the same sequence, but having the A twice here actually matters. So removing one of the A's will not give me the same sequence, but a different one. So is that a valid sequence? Yes. No.
Is it fulfills the definition?
Sorry?
It fulfills the definition.
Well, it is a sequent. Yeah, that's okay. By valid, I mean I didn't mean it passes the typing.
Okay.
By valid, I mean it's actually true under all valuations of A and B. So, were you going to answer that? Or?
Yeah.
So,
we know about A. Gable.
Sorry.
Not Gable. A holds and A by B holds. So we know that B holds, and if we know that A holds and B holds, we know that A and B holds.
Okay, that was a correct proof that this is a valid sequence, yes. Can it be made shorter?
A holds, so B holds, so everything holds.
And well, yeah, okay. Yeah, that was basically just more cavalier as a proof rather than therefore shorter. Yeah, of course, I mean, I could also just say anyone can see that it holds, and that's a very short proof. So, so you were arguing that on the right side we can conclude B and we can also conclude A and B. Was that necessary?
We only have to conclude one, of course.
Right. The right-hand side is disjunctive. So can somebody basically name a minimal subsequent of this thing that would still be valid?
For a scheme of sequence.
No, this is supposed to stand for atoms. So are atoms small or?
You wrote atoms as small letters.
Oh, atoms are supposed to be, then let's stick to that. Okay, so atoms are lowercase. Yeah, no, very good. I mean, I would have continued like this the whole session. Yeah, right, that's because they're usually lowercase in modal logic, so that's why they're restricted to this. Okay, yeah, coming back to this, so minimal subsequent of this thing that would still be done.
Yep. From A and A plus B equals B.
Right, so this one here is, well, minimal means I can't remove anything from it, right? So. Minimal should not be confused with smallest, right? So this doesn't. So it's not clear that this is the smallest subsequent that I find here that would be valid. Well, maybe it actually is, but never mind. But what I did mean was minimal, so minimal in the sense that I cannot make it even smaller without destroying the limit. So if I remove this A here, then I get A implies B, and from this I conclude B. This is not valid because only these two here.
We don't know that A holds, so we can't conclude to that theory.
Yeah, so I meant an actual semantic argument. So this was a proof, an argument about impossibility of proof, but I haven't actually given the proof system, right? So when I say it's not valid, that must mean there's a valuation of A and B that falsifies it, right? So, what is that valuation?
A is false and B is false.
A and B both false falsifies this, right? Because if A is false, then this here becomes true. False implies anything. And, well, this is false because B is false, so true here, false there, so it's not a valid conclusion. Okay.
Well, here we don't have now notation distinguishing sequence from valid sequence. So the definition of the sequence would be then that this is just a pair of multisets separated by a dense style, or it should be a valid one.
No. I mean, the definition is as it says, right? A sequence needn't be valid, right? I mean, a sequence is just a pair of multisets, a formula separated by a turnstile. I haven't actually said when a sequence is valid, right? So do that now. I'm saying a sequence is valid if and only if I'm going to write the formula very shortly, right? I'm going to use this big conjunction for sets of formulas, right? So so if gamma is this list of formulas here, read as a multiset, then the conjunction of gamma is just the conjunction of all these things front to back, and same of course for big disjunction. And I write this, have I actually defined this in my mind? Well, I have. So, if and only if the corresponding propositional logic formula is valid, right? So that's our definition of a valid sequence. Yeah.
If the empty set, gamma and delta are the empty set, what else?
Right. I guess somebody can answer that. So what is the big conjunction of the empty set or empty multiset?
False.
Mm-hmm. You don't get to participate in the games, come on. Okay.
In a way you already showed last time it cannot be false because we discussed whether empty set can be satisfied or not, right? This happened in the last lecture. So this should give some sort of...
Oh, story. Right, yes. So it's easiest to basically phrase this in terms of obligations. So, I mean, it's just a convention. So I'm now trying to argue for this convention. I'm by no means trying to prove it. I'm just trying to tell you it's sensible. So so the conjunction of the empty set is false. Why is that? Well, if I have a conjunction of three things, I have to make three things too. If I have a conjunction of two things, I have to make two things true.
It's false.
Sorry?
The conjunction of empty set is false.
And I said false.
You said false.
Oh, no, true, sorry. So the conjunction of the empty set is true. So again, let me start my argument. Right? So the conjunction of, in a conjunction of three things, I have to make three things true. In a conjunction of only two things, I have to make only two things true. That's easier. Right? In a conjunction of one thing, I have to make only that thing true. That's even easier. In a conjunction of nothing, I have to make nothing true, so I don't have to do anything. That's very easy, at least for me. So right, not having to make anything true and getting a true statement means that conjunction of the empty set is true. And similarly, the disjunction of the empty set is false because, well, if I have a, I'm going to start at 2 to make it less lengthy, right? So if I have a disjunction of two things, then I have two chances to make my statement true, on the left and on the right. Well, a disjunction of one thing, I have one chance to make that true by making that very thing true. And a disjunction of zero things, I have no chance to make that true, right? So that's false. So let's write this down explicitly. Conjunction of the empty set is true. And disjunction of the empty set is false. Okay, so that's sequence.
But actually this relates to this point of about turnstile. Actually Gensler was not using turnstile. He was using a separate arrow. Actually, the arrow that we use now for implication, at that time he was using this round arrow for coming back to physical mathematical and something like that. And the turnstile notation comes from Fred. Later people started to replace this sequence arrow by the turnstile. But if we use both, then one could simply write turnstile in front of valid sequence. I guess this is the convention that we are going to do because it's not helpful. But normally, there are some references where people are writing turnstile and then a sequence, and then the first would be set, the second would be set, are separated by a second arrow, which is another kind of arrow, given the implication.
Okay, right. So in particular, we won't have nice notation for a sequence as derivable, right? Because we need a turnstile in front of something that contains a turnstile again. But, yeah, I mean, this is standard these days.
Yes.
So, what can we do? Right, so, okay, so that's what we're talking about, are syntactic objects, and we want to manipulate them in proofs. And now the nice thing is that these proofs, they're not going to be hierarchic anymore. I've already got one level of hierarchy in here, evidently, because, there's a reason that this thing here is written as a turnstile, because it morally means derivability. But we don't have to nest this further, so we just manipulate these things in a flat proof system that doesn't have further hierarchy. So. Basically, we have a set of sequence rules that allow us to derive sequence. And as in the case of natural deduction, these are now morally grouped into elimination and introduction rules, except they're no longer called that, because we want to see these two sides of the turnstile as symmetric. So instead of elimination and introduction, we're just going to call them left and right, depending on whether symbols appear to the left or to the right of the turnstile. And, well, yes, we group them as left and right rules, and moreover, we group them by connective, as we already did in the natural deduction system. So basically, there's left rules and right rules for all the connectives. Let's start with the easiest one. So they're more or less all structured in the same way. Basically, I have a proof rule where a composite formula mentioning my connective, in this case, and, appears somewhere. Of course, because I don't care about... That is your fault, actually. So, it appears somewhere, and well, where it appears, I need only distinguish according to whether it appears on the left or on the right. Once I've determined that, as in this case, it appears on the left, I can use the fact that I mean the order not to matter, so I can just write it at the end here. What we have to keep in mind, and which may sometimes be confusing, is that this gamma here, the rest of the multiset, may contain further occurrences of this same formula here, right? So this one that I'm dealing with currently need not be the only occurrence of the formula. So in particular, once I've got rid of it, I can by no means assume that gamma no longer contains this A and B. But nevertheless, so when I have one occurrence, I can assume that it occurs last, basically, or first, or whatever I like, just to ease my notation.
Aren't we talking about atoms anymore? Or
this shouldn't be atom. Thank you. This is. It gets more confusing because many standard presentation texts use capital letters for the formulas. So these are meant to be arbitrary formulas, not atoms. And of course, an atom would have the lowercase anyway. So formulas, fine stuff. Okay, I want to prove this. Any suggestions on what I should put here as the premise? So this here says I want to show that I'm able to conclude something from some assumptions that include phi and psi. And I want something on top that gets rid of this occurrence of conjunction. Yeah, right. I mean, I just kill the conjunction. And write a comma instead. I mean, on the left, the comma is read conjunctively anyway, right? So I can just get rid of the conjunction and write the two formulas separately. Okay, so this is exactly what I do in proofs, of course. I mean, if I know I can use a conjunction in my proofs, then that's the same as saying I can use both of the conjuncts whenever I like. So this has a name. Right, you connect it first. So this is the left rule for conjunction because, well, conjunction appears on the left and it's basically processed by moving up here. Although Wikipedia is not a citable source, like any encyclopedia, I should add, I mean, the Encyclopedia Britannica is also not a citable reference. Although that is the case, I myself really like to look things up on Wikipedia. I should warn you that the rules that you find on Wikipedia for this case are wrong. I was going to correct it, but it's topographically complicated, I think, so I got wrong. So we'll discuss this later, maybe, for a time. Okay, so then obviously we need a right rule. So in this case, our conjunction appears to the right of the turnstile. So this is now, I mean, yeah, the right-hand side is always a bit confusing to read, right? You just have to get used to it. The easiest way to think about the right-hand side is that it's really symmetric to the left-hand side. So, of course, that doesn't mean that the connectives behave the same on both sides, but it's just best not to think about it too much. So this here says that from assumptions in gamma, and can derive that either phi and psi hold or something else. It doesn't sound very useful, but it is. So, in order to prove this, what would I have to establish? It's best to forget about the or something else for a moment. Just pretend it's not there. Basically, what I have to do to prove the conjunction.
You can deduct it from gamma phi, and you can deduct from gamma psi.
Right, so this is what I expect, and if I look at a natural deduction system and try to formalize it here, actually the delta wouldn't really be there, right? But we need it anyway. So the question is now, what do I do about the delta? Well, I just add it in both places. We'll do a soundness proof later. You will find that this actually is sound. Okay, then connectives. Well, there's only two, right? And negation. So left rule for negation. So I want to prove that from gamma and not phi, I can deduce delta. I won't let you guess this rule. Basically, what happens is the phi just goes to the right-hand side and loses its negation. So if we think about how this is coded as a clause, right, over formulas, then it's clear that it works that way. I mean, either I have something on the left, in which case, well, I forget about the negation, right? And so for that thing there, not phi on the left, would be in reality not phi. Or I put it on the right. By just including the not here. Right? So basically, not, it basically has the symmetric effect. I mean, just it's just a decision on how I group my literals in a plot consisting of literals. Okay, and once we're seeing this, the right rule is fairly obvious, so now I have the not appearing on the right, and by the same argument, I can just move it to the left. Now, what can I prove in this system? Of course, this is meant to be an inductive system. I can prove a sequent if I can write down a proof with finitely many steps. That, well, it's effectively then tree-shaped because I've got this conjunctive branching in the right rule for AND, right? So it's going to be some sort of finite tree that ends in my target sequent. So what sequence can I prove in the system?
Right now, none.
Right. Why?
Because there are no axioms, so sequence rules with no
right.
Conditions.
So there's no sequence rules with no conditions. Exactly. So we evidently need one additional rule that will allow me to just write down the sequence directly. Any suggestions? Basically, I should find some property of a sequent that makes it bloody obvious that this thing is a valid sequent.
From A, we got A.
So this here is quite clearly a valid sequent, right? If I assume A, then I can conclude A. And some systems include it in this form. Here I want it in a slightly more general form, that is, I want additional rubbish allowed on both the left and the right hand side. And of course, and lowercase, yeah, thank you. So, does that precisely reflect what you said?
Without gamma, yeah.
All right, because there's one other slightly more general rule that one might think of. Correcting the typo meant to be an atom, right?
You could sort of
We could use an arbitrary formula and then put in the place of A, so let's call this X prime and put it in brackets. We will show that we don't actually need X prime. We'll show that all the instances of X prime are already derivable in the current system as it stands. We'll probably do that tomorrow as part of the tutorial because it's rather similar to some things that are on the sheet. It's not an entirely academic question whether to do it as X or X prime. So later, of course, or actually already now, I mean, these are systems that are actually implemented. Well, actually, nobody will probably really implement the sequent prover for classical propositional logic because instead you do set proving and have this, you know, highly optimized range of tools that you can use instead of they're not usually based on sequences. But as soon as you move to more complex logics, this is actually what you do. So when you build a description logic reasoner and stuff like that, then, some dualization aside, this is more or less the system that you use. And it is then a highly practical question on whether I want this rule or this rule. Can somebody, from the point of view of building a prover, outline the differences between this rule and this rule? I mean, what makes one side, what kind of efficiency impact, or what kind of impact on efficiency do these rules have? Like, what's good about either of So, I mean, it is true that this rule here, X prime, it will save you part of the proof, right? So the proof will be finished here, while here, if you implement only this rule and arrive at a sequence like this, then the system will keep running until it has taken phi apart sufficiently to actually detect atolic axes. On the other hand, in order to do this here, you have to actually find two syntactically equal formulas on the two sides. Well, not only do you have to compare these two, if you want to check a sequent on applicability of this rule, right, you have to check all pairs of formulas whether they happen to syntactically match. And formula is going to be an algebraic data type, so a formula is something going to be something that sits on the heap somewhere, right? So you have to follow pointers through the heap effectively, even if you use a highly abstract language, the actual things that are going to happen on the compiled level are going to do just that. I mean, they're going to pursue pointers on the heap and see that the structures are the same on both sides. So this will take time. So there's, most of the time, there's no actual advantage in using X prime instead of just X. Right, so that's the full system now. Let's maybe do a proof in it. So, let me pick something at random. So this here, is actually a valid formula, although it looks nonsensical. A implies B, or B implies A. That's one of the so-called paradoxes of material implication. I mean, it doesn't sound like something that an implication should verify, but it does. Okay, now we don't have rules for implication and or as yet, so we'll have to decode it. So what does this mean? This here says not... So this here is the implications decoded.
not A and not B, or not B and not A. And decoding further now this disjunction here, well, let's say I can let it commute by the Morgan's law with the negation here, so the actual decoding would be slightly more complicated. Oh no, come on, again. Yeah. This is sort of ingrained because I do it that way in Gloid, right? So A will notice eventually. So, okay, so let's decode this. I pull out the negation signs, and this gives me not. Okay. Now decoding it that way, it already makes it already look rather less surprising than it looked when written with implication signs. And nevertheless, we still have some stuff to do if we actually want to prove that this is done. Right? So, have a go. So, of course, what we want to show is that this sequence here is valid, right? So I'm talking about validity of a single formula, then this becomes validity of that formula as the single formula on the right of a transitive that doesn't have anything on the left. Stuff will appear on both sides as you progress. What I mean, of course, is to derive this in the system, right? Not to try out truth values. I mean, okay, that's quickly done as well because there's only four combinations that you have to try. But what I mean is to come up with the proof in the sequence system using the rules, right? Of course, pull up the full set of rules so you can see it. Ja, es haben dann schon etliche guten, vielleicht, was immer. Wenn man sich dabei erwischen lässt, dass man es löst, nicht? Dann muss man auch was.
So,
on the board, please. Nobody can digest these proofs when they're just read out. So, I mean, we have to write them on the board. For purposes of writing such proofs also on paper, it's often helpful to develop them standing on their head, right? So that would be completely legal to just, instead of building them bottom up, it's always hard.
I did it from bottom up, though.
Okay, yeah.
So, that's where we start. The only rule that matched, which is the negation right rule. So I pretty much kicked it over to the left and removed the negation sign. Then I just used the left side conjunction rule twice.
The way you write it now, you only use it once, right?
This is about it. The next time I use it twice. So I just use it for each one of them once. And then I can
pretty much bring over these two to the right side using the negation left side rule twice.
Suffice to do that once, right? I mean, we don't really need both of them on the right. Well, I mean, the, effectively, this thing contains two occurrences of axiom, right? So,
well, then we're done.
Okay. Right, thanks a lot. Yeah, let me indicate the simplification that I mentioned. So it's not actually necessary to solve both the negations. So let's say we keep one not B on the left, and we only shove this not A here to the right, and we can apply the axiom rule already here because we have this A and this A. Right? So another big simplification, just one less simplification. Okay, so this is how these things work. Now, of course, we have the two notions to compare, right? We have our notion of validity of a sequent, which basically says that, well, the formula that I associate with the sequent is valid, is true under all valuations for the propositional atoms. And I've got this notion of derivability in my sequent rule calculus. And of course, ideally, these should coincide, and luckily, it turns out they do. So, let's see. So now we're going to prove a theorem. Well, this one, this half, doesn't quite deserve the name theorem, but it's so symmetric to the actual theorem that comes next that one cannot really do otherwise. So, the theorem states soundness of our system. So what it says is, if a sequent is derivable, that means, of course, derivable under the sequent rules that we've just given. The slogan is soundness proofs are always easy. That's not generally true, so there are systems whose soundness proof is not easy, and in fact there are even unsound systems in the literature, so sometimes soundness proofs go wrong, or maybe people tend to think they're trivial and forget them, or something like that. So, but in this case, the soundness proof really is trivial. I'm not going to write that it's trivial, I'm going to actually do it at least in part. Okay, let me phrase this more conservatively. Soundness proofs in well-founded proof systems are trivial. So soundness proofs start becoming difficult as soon as you accept cycles in your proofs.
While proofs are harmless objects, or as long as proofs are harmless objects such as these, so they're just trees, finite trees, nothing much can go wrong unless you really maldesigned your rules. Because the proofs are finite objects, you can do induction over. So what does that mean exactly? Well, a proof looks like a tree, right? This tree here has been rather linear, okay, but in principle there could have been branching if we had to apply the right rule for conjunction, then there would be branching. So in general, a proof looks something like this. And basically, I can do induction saying, well, for instance, here in this last step, I assume that this part here is correct, and I assume that this part here is correct, so what's being proved here is actually a valid sequence, and then I prove that this here that comes last is a valid sequence from that assumption. What that boils down to, in slightly less over-formalized terms, is to show that the rules preserve validity. So of course, if the rules preserve valid sequence, and of course, for the axiom rule, that means that the axioms are all valid, then of course, all I'm going to be able to prove from the rules is going to be valid sequence only. So, let me do this for some of these rules. So I have to show that, in this case, if all the premises are valid, well, there is no premise, so I have nothing to assume, then the conclusion is valid, well, this conclusion here, which states that a conjunction in which A is one of the conjuncts implies a disjunction in which A is one of the disjuncts, well, that is clearly valid. Right, so that's what we picked it for, something that is totally, blatantly, obviously valid. Okay, this one here should be fairly obvious, right? So if basically, this here states validity of a conjunction in which I get phi and psi here at the end, and here I've just written out that conjunction, and it would be hard to even turn that into a proof that isn't totally tautological. This here is maybe not quite that obvious. The part without the delta is obvious, but as soon as I write the delta in there, it's maybe no longer quite that obvious, so let's just do the proof on the right. So I've got my, I've got my two assumptions of the rule, so the premises of the rule, and I'm assuming they're valid. So, I've got a definition of what that means. So that means well, I translate these into formulas, right? Here I get conjunction of gamma implies phi or disjunction of delta, and similarly for psi. These are both valid as propositional formulas. Okay. Now the confusing bit is this disjunction here, right? Like, of course, I can just now validate a corresponding rule that would allow me to conclude to make this conclusion with the disjunction on the right here. But let's just do this ad hoc. Basically, this disjunction here can be brought to the left. Right? So this here says that if my assumption here on the left hand of the implication is true, and, well, in the disjunction that follows, the right-hand disjunct is not true, then the left-hand disjunct must be true. This is our classical view of a disjunction, right? That a disjunction is true means that if one of the disjunct isn't true, then the other one must be true. So this here is obviously equivalent to if the conjunction of gamma is true and the disjunction of delta is not true, then phi is true. And of course the same for psi, so same implication with psi instead of phi, they're both valid. Well, now I can see it, right? Now I have two formulas that I conclude from the same assumptions in an implication. So that, of course, I can join. So that is the formula that I get by taking the conjunction of gamma and the negation of the disjunction of delta implies phi and psi. That formula is valid. And now, of course, I can bring this to the right again. The implication saying that the conjunction of gamma implies phi or psi or disjunction of delta is valid, and that implies that the sequent in the conclusion of my rule is also valid. So now I've proved that the rule preserves valid sequence. Okay, now there's two remaining, right? But these actually work precisely the same way that the thing that I did in between here with delta works, right? So basically, if I have a disjunction on the right, I can just shift disjuncts to the left of the implication and turn them into negations. Basically, the whole secret of the soundness of these rules here is that an implication phi implies psi is just equivalent to not phi or psi by definition, right? So that's really all that's behind these negations.
You switch to sequent arrow then in the book.
No. Well, this is meant to be a proportional
error.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes?
The last two steps, phi and psi should be conjugated, right?
Here, yes. Otherwise, okay. That's the soundness proof, which I would conclude here, basically. Having omitted most of the rules. Any questions? Okay. So the other thing that this proof shows is that as soon as I actually revert to propositional logic, it doesn't really matter that much that there are several things to the right hand of the turnstile, right? I can always push them to the left if I want to. Okay.
Next, completeness. I have, as you will observe, 10 minutes left. I was claiming that completeness is usually the hard direction. Yes, completeness in this case is not quite as trivial as soundness, but it's still not at all hard. The reason for that is that it's, I mean, classical propositional logic is not a very complicated logic, so to speak. Okay, how do I prove completeness of this system? So first of all, what is completeness of the system? Well, this is the opposite implication, right? So I'm saying that if a sequence gamma delta is valid, then it's derivable. Okay, how do I prove this? I prove it by contraposition. Suppose that the sequence is not derivable. And of course, I have to show that it's not valid, so I have to somehow construct a valuation that makes the sequence false. And I do this by a case distinction. And the case distinction is over which rules are applicable to my sequence. And, okay, what for the first possibility here is that no rule is applicable to the sequence. Okay, what does it mean that no rule applies to a sequence? Well, what I can see in my system here is as soon as I see a logic connective anywhere in the sequence, I can apply a rule that will remove that connective. So if there is no rule applicable, that means there are no connectives in gamma and delta. And also, well, if there are no connectives, then gamma and delta consist only of atoms. And this rule isn't applicable. That means gamma and delta don't intersect. Right? They have no atom in common. Otherwise, I would be able to apply the axiom rule, and in fact, I would prove gamma. Prove gamma and tails delta. Okay, then it's easy for me to construct a valuation that invalidates the implication. First of all, well, what do I have to do? I have to make this implication from gamma to disjunction of delta false. So I better make gamma true. So whenever an atom is in gamma, I make it true. Otherwise, I make it false. Then, of course, gamma kappa satisfies gamma. I've constructed it that way. And it doesn't satisfy delta, meaning it doesn't satisfy a single one of the atoms in delta. Recall that delta is read disjunctively, so as soon as one of the atoms in delta is true, delta would be true. But, so, let me write this
kappa satisfies the big conjunction of gamma, and it doesn't satisfy the big disjunction of delta. So for this part here, we need to know that gamma and delta are disjoint. So I make only the atoms in gamma true, but that doesn't include any of the atoms in delta, because they're disjoint. And then, of course, kappa does not satisfy this implication here, so this is not a valid formula, so this means that our secant is not valid. Okay, now 4 minutes left. Being able to do it in 10 minutes was a bit of a boast, because I didn't expect that the easy case would take me 6 minutes, even without interruptions. So I'll leave the second case as a cliffhanger for tomorrow. What do I do in case a rule does apply? Okay, so I'll just take questions from here on. And there are some of the things that we have to do tomorrow. We have to give an example showing that certain structural rules are admissible, because that's one thing that you're asked to do on the sheet. And the other thing is we have to understand what failure of proof search in our system, which is basically what happens in case in the implication that we're showing here, because the secant isn't derivable basically says that proof search fails. So I want to do that without rushing, so I'll leave that for tomorrow as well. Are there any questions on the first half of the proof for now? Okay, then basically I'll see you tomorrow. And please take a look at the sheet later. I'll put it online in the few minutes that I have between this lecture and the next, so you maybe will see it at least.
And follow the hooks.
Right?
And think about groups that you want to
call. I'm thinking about groups, yeah.